Okay, good.
Welcome, everyone. This is a class on the Eightfold Path, and it's a year-long series in which we are exploring with some detail and with some interest and hopefully with some enthusiasm the array of steps on the Eightfold Path. And for those of you who might have missed the first two series of this series, the first and second Noble Truth and the third Noble Truth, I would suggest you going back and listening to at least one of those talks in each of those series so that you just get caught up, so you get a sense of where we're coming from here. Because we're taking off now in a life-asserting way. We've heard that there is self-inflicted pain, and we have oriented ourselves to the problem of why and how it is that we inflict that pain upon ourselves. And we've also heard the good news, the lion roar of the Buddha, that there is a liberation from continuing to cause that pain. And now we're looking at the methodology, the way and the means, how it is that we orient our life in all aspects of it, so that we can live in accordance with untying the knot of that self-inflicted destruction, conflict, struggle that we are tied within. So tonight we're going to move into the second step, which is wise intention. We spent three talks on wise view. That is the view and orientation that we are never going to be able to work our way out of in a, the view of being individuated and separate entities. You can work forever within the struggle and struggle forever with that view. If you don't change it, if you don't look at the assumptions that it's based and challenge those assumptions, then you will... And if you just operate from it, then all of your practices will act in accordance to further harden that basic assumption of I, me, and mine. And so ultimately, although we may have moments of generosity and love and lightness, ultimately it will be towards self-improvement, self-enhancement. And that really isn't the way of the Buddha. The way of the teaching, the way of freedom, is towards the liberation from that view, so that when we look through our eyes, it's no longer convincing that there are 2 or 10 or 200 of us in this room. That there is some mistaken way that we perceive life, and that that perception of life can be, we can release ourselves from that constant perception of life to intimate the feeling of oneness, of union, of interconnection. Now, many of us have had that initial aha experience in spirituality when, at some point, somewhere along your journey, you really, either through insight, through an altered perception, or just through words that feel so right to you, that you know they're true just by how deeply they feel right. And that sense of aha is the first energetic extrication of our belief that the life we have lived has been of separation, has been true, and that there's something more true, more inviting, more in line with reality than what we have mistaken our lives to be. And then very quickly, because it's not affirmed, it's not integrated, most of us find ourselves acting and betraying that initial euphoria. And we find ourselves trying to get back to it, perhaps, but somehow it feels very remote, and we might as well get on with our life. And many people do just that. They forget that insight, that revelation, and they move back into the drudgery of their life because that must have just been some slight distortion of mind in that moment or something. I don't know what we make of it. Others of us, it grabs much deeper. And you find yourself in sanghas or satsangs or something, trying to bring forth an acclimation, a realization, ongoing living experience of that understanding. So that's the Buddhist tradition, is we want to live this thing. And if it has highs, fine. That was great, the aha experience, and that was great, wonderful. But if it carries lows, we're now sophisticated enough in our meditation and know that we deal with all of that, because it can't be just the height of the and the elation of that momentary experience that we try to embrace, because when we do that, we find ourselves in pain when in its absence. And that cues us that we're doing something wrong, because the First Noble Truth says that if you're in pain, you're doing something wrong. And so when you find yourself in pain, if you listen to that pain rather than to act from it unconsciously, which is most of our normal experience, to try to get over it or to get rid of it, but rather to look at it, then you find that there's something that you're inviting in life that isn't there, that you're some way that you're manufacturing or idealizing life to be altered in some way. And so that alteration of our expectation, of our anticipation, of the way we're holding, of our thinking, ultimately falls down in ruin, and that's called pain. That's called suffering. And so the first proclamation, the first step is the ground on which all the other steps are based, and that's wise view. The wise view is that I'm no longer going to use my life for self-fulfilling reasons. Self-fulfilling. That sounds like the right way to go, doesn't it? I want to be self-fulfilled. No, it's not. So let's just pull the rug right out from that. It's not about self-fulfillment. It's not, because self-fulfillment ultimately leads towards our own suffering. But rather, it's about something from the heart, something that we can't quite express, we can't quite grasp, we can't quite verbalize, we can't quite authenticate, but we know it's there, and we feel it deeply in us, deeply, embedded deeply. Why does the Dharma have such a hold on us? I'm not hypnotizing anyone. Why do you come? Because there's something in the words that strike you into wise you, that tap you, that touch your knowledge, your certainty, your confidence of wise view, of interconnection. We talk about interconnection in terms of lots of different ways. Affection, compassion, love, wholeness, communion, which is what the wafer is about in Christianity. But we don't move with it in action, speech, and mind. So it remains kind of an aspiration rather than a reality. It remains something that's hidden, because our lives continue to be confusing. Our lives continue to be used in accordance with a different view. You can't have spiritual aspirations in one view and have your life lived in another view and expect your life to ever fold into your spiritual understanding. They will be at odds with one another forever. And if you start walking it in accordance with your spiritual, then it starts working towards your benefit, towards ultimately your benefit, which is not self-fulfillment. Now, many of us feel so deprived in ourself that self-fulfillment sounds like something that's very appealing and a delightful goal to have. So many of us have to find a sense of self-fulfillment before we have the maturity and readiness to move into interconnection, which is what the Rumi poem was saying. But ultimately, that sense of interconnection is the most fulfilling thing. When we grow beyond the boundary, beyond the border, beyond the identification with I, me, or mine, so that we see that as a functional label to use and navigate the world, but not pointing to something that has any reliable certainty. And so wise view then has to be set forth energetically. It's, you can't just have your aha experience, have a wise view, understanding, and then just let it dissipate, because it will. Because the other view holds much more conditioned momentum than the wise view of that moment or day or week that you had that elevating experience. So it has to be tied with an intentionality. We have to tie energetically. Intention is the second step, because we've got to get this thing moving. We've got to get this thing moving from just a glance into the integration of body, speech, and mind, which livelihood, all of the different next steps on the Eightfold Path. And intention is the beginning of that, of the movement from it being a momentary realization to being incorporated and integrated within the cells of our being. The cells of our being know that you are not separate. And so the extrication of energy really moves from the brain, from living our life in the top 3 inches of our skull, to living our life in the full 6 feet of our body. And that requires an intentionality. And intentionality really means there's a lot of words that are incorporated within intentionality, including aspiration, including inspiration. For me, it holds a kind of attitude. There's a kind of attitude that we have with life from that. Resolve is a very important aspect of intention, where you just, this is what my life's going to be about. You know, I'm not going to argue, keep arguing with this. The logical world that loves killing its own species. I'm not going to be a part of that. Not going to be a part of that. So my resolve now is to use my life in a different direction, and a direction of inner connection. The Buddha said, wise intention leads to greater contentment, and unwise intention leads to greater dissatisfaction. He just sort of said it, just plain. You know, he didn't embellish it. He says, you want to go left or you want to go right? Because here's the opportunity. Now, where we get sidetracked in this movement of intentionality towards wise view, inner connection, which if we talk about it in terms of an organ, which I like to do, although it's not exactly the heart that we think of, but the heart represents a kind of abiding in awareness and affection and love and compassion, in the movements of basic goodness in life. So if you'll let me use that word, then where the energy becomes extracted from is the brain, and where it moves to is the heart. Now, the heart doesn't have the brain's organizational capacity. It doesn't see in defined and definite terms. It doesn't see in secure ways. It doesn't see in definitive poses or descriptions. It just has an intuitive sense about it, an unknowing sense. It's the holder of mystery. I like that, the holder of mystery. It's the holder of mystery. And therefore, when we walk it down, energetically down, it feels very confusing. Doesn't feel like the world we've lived in. Now, it's interesting, because many of you will sit down in your meditation and you'll have 45 minutes or however long you sit, and you'll have that energy starting to extract itself from the brain into the heart, because you'll start feeling more aligned with basic connectedness, which is what the meditation is to do. So you start feeling your emotions without I, me, or minding it, which is the brain's interpretation, but just feeling it, letting it be, giving it space and giving it a lot of room. You open your eyes and suddenly the real world comes back in. But you feel a little bit out of sorts with the real world because you've been living 45 minutes in the altered state or whatever we call it, which is really the real world, but we want the false real world. So we want to get ourselves back into the proper orientation to things, so we will find ourselves quite likely at the refrigerator door. Or something, some way to get back the sense of desire or fear, or you'll get busy all of a sudden. Right? I've got things to do. Enough of this sitting around. Right? You'll crank it back up. You'll put your foot to the accelerator. You'll be off in movement. And you'll just deny what that 45 minutes, that transformation that was occurring. Because it's too unsettling. Feels too, I don't know, doesn't feel quite like me. Duh. There's something, when you feel less and less like you, you're on to something. You're on to something. If you keep wanting to feel just like you're feeling now and be spiritual, well, that's an oxymoron. You see, where are we going to release it? But one of the great inhibitors and the great brain's trust, the vaults of the brain, the Oz behind the curtain, is self-struggle, personal pain. Because that'll drive you up to the brain quicker than anything. The logistics of the brain are, I've got to get out of this, I've got to seek comfort, I've got to seek strategies away from this pain, I have to solve the problems of my life and the problems of my personality, and I have much more transformation to do and much more improvement, and I'm a mess. That's behind the vault. Take away, that's it. That's what the Wizard of Oz is telling you. And it's a wonderful way to keep you on track, keep you destined within unwise view. Forever. Because you'll never be finished. The brain will not allow you to be finished with your transformation. So if transformation is going to occur, you better have an understanding of how to work with pain. Because if you don't have that, which is the first and second noble truth, first, second, and third noble truth, you see how all these things are absolutely interconnected. Not that I'm not, which is the subject of the, well, his teaching is interconnected. Sometimes it feels so, it's like when you just see this thing, it's like a most beautiful flower. And it has to be right. You know, sometimes things are right because of the beauty they manifest. That's like the Four Noble Truths. But the sense of personal pain and having to move from it drives unwise view. The moment you're willing to go into the pain to find out what is causing the pain, not what you can do to cure yourself, to make yourself better so that you will never have pain again, that's unwise view, but to move into the pain, to look at the genetic code of the pain, to see why it's occurring. What's going on here? What's the causation? And to release ourselves from the fixed response, the fixed posture the pain puts us in. In other words, just open to it. Take ourselves out of it. The I, me, and mine has nothing to do with the pain. It feels as if it does, and if we are willing to wade through the historical reference that ties us to self-improvement, which has no has absolutely no place within the present moment. But unwise you doesn't carry the present moment. Unwise view carries the future in which this problem will be resolved. Wise view carries the moment. Wise view carries the moment. Because that's the only place interconnection can happen. What do you think it's going to happen in abstraction? Going to happen conceptually? It's either going to happen here in reality or it's not going to happen. And now is the only moment that holds reality. So unwise view tries to get you out of now, away from now. But your intentionality keeps, nope. You see, that's when last week or 2 weeks ago I talked about radical accountability. Radical accountability is that absolute unwillingness to play the strategies, to play the games of unwise view any longer. To accuse, to blame, to beat oneself up. That's all gone. That's all just a part of the fabric of keeping ourselves in a distorted world of species killing species. See, where's your deepest longing? If you want to know what to form an intention around, form an intention around your deepest longing. Your deepest longing. Have you ever chanted? Not a dry chant, a warm chant, a warm-hearted chant from a different tradition. And you just feel this longing from the chant because it activates the heart, which is what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to activate the source from which wise view comes. And you fall into this beautiful space of innocence and purity. But we don't trust it, you see. As long as we're chanting, we can allow ourselves to be there. But when we come out of it, we don't trust it. But it's from that longing. It's accessing that longing. And then forming an intention around that longing. Because what's the longing doing but pulling us down? Pulling us away from the specifics. Pulling us away from the distinctive qualities of things. Pulling us towards the source that holds no distinction. And how many of us take a seat there for our intention? Because you see, what really happens is that we have multiple levels of intention. Our brain has an intention, doesn't it? It's an intention around you, around your self-fulfillment. Around what you need to be fulfilled as a human being. All the things that you need to do, which consume our day with activity, and then we're building perhaps towards retirement or some kind of future. Then we're too old to do any of the things we could have done when we were young and had the energy and the money to do it. Anyway. None of it makes any sense. It doesn't. None of it makes any sense when you look at it. I don't know what. Sometimes it just gets so obvious that I don't understand why we're doing it. You know, it's like I'm just saying the obvious. And yet we just keep doing it. I love life too much for that, don't you? See, why does the Dharma hold such, you know, it's like that. Immediately the hands form into a mudra. See, that's the longing. Your hands come together within that longing, within that pull. Then you know what life's about. You know what life's like when you know what it's about. But where's the intentionality? It has to, go into body, speech, and mind. And it's only through intentionality that you can take the view and energetically assert the direction for it. The view is very lovely, but if you keep saying, oh, that's just, I'm just being naive. Okay, let me get back to my life. If you keep coming and shaking yourself out of the meditation so that you can get back into your real life, you keep that intentionality at a low level. The real deep intentionality. And you move with the mind's intentionality. The mind's intentionality, as I mentioned, has its own logic, its own strategies. You know them because we're all working with those. We're all operating within that most of the time. And it has its own purpose, its own intention, and, you know, but, and it completely confiscates the longing. In fact, it does worse than that. It distorts the longing from the longing, the intentionality is completely gone. The longing's still there because as a human being, that's what we are. We long for the source of returning to. So as we long, that heart begins to continue to express the perfume of its longing. What does the mind do with that? Because the mind can only see in separate and distinct and unwise ways, it says there's something outside of me that I need for completion. That's how it thinks. It thinks in self and other. Longing is nothing like that. Longing is an invitation to dive into the source, to dive away from your separation. But we use the longing to reassert our desire and fear and avoidance. That's insane. And so, obviously, tragedy is going to happen when you take something that wants you to merge and you're making yourself more separate and distinct from those intentions. Well, there's hell that's going to be paid. And there will be. You pursue desire and fear. You don't have to, I don't have to tell you that. That's what our lives have been about. And once in a while, we have it together to move from the first level, the mind's intentionality, into the second intentionality. And that journey, energetically, is what is called spiritual practice. A friend of mine was telling me a story where he drove from Seattle up to Vancouver Airport. And friends of his were flying in from London. And so he drove up very early in the morning to Vancouver Airport from Seattle. Except that day that they were supposed to fly in was the day that all that havoc happened in London, all the liquid bomb and all that sort of stuff. And so the plane that was supposed to fly from London kept getting delayed. And so he waited in the airport 8 hours for his friend's flight, which never arrived because it turned out that they had taken another flight and were already at home in Seattle. And he didn't know that because he had no way to. So what did he do? He sat and walked at the airport. He didn't make himself miserable. He didn't create this whole scene of a wasted day. He said, okay, first intention, not there. First level of intention, not there. Let me go to the deeper sense of connection about what this life is. We have that opportunity in every chance, every activity that we make from first level intention. Because it never, very rarely goes according to plan. And what do? We spend our time frustrating. We energetically use the time for frustration and annoyance, which is a first level intention response. It's about circumstances. It's about events. It's about them. It's about planes and terrorists. Right? It's not about the integrated heart. Why do we do that? We have to understand what we get out of doing that. What we get out of it is pomp and circumstance and righteousness and The real order of the universe is the way I think it should be. No care, and this is the improper orient. So orientation of the universe is the proper way the universe is arising. So we've got to do something about terrorists and this and that. And so therefore we have wars and on we go. So that's the logical conclusion of spending the wrong 8 hours at the airport. You start a gun battle. So this is our life. Do you see it? Because I can't give it to you. And we're wasting our time if we're just going to use it as a sermon or as some kind of talk and not move deeply with resolution, with an intentionality, with a resolve. You see, it's a matter of changing views. As long as we hold the view on the of unwise view, then the intentionality of our life will be in accordance with that view. You see? It can't be otherwise. Now, it's interesting. There's a story of, in the Buddhist time, there was a sect that was contemporary to the Buddhists in the early days, and they were the Hindu sect of the Jains. And so there's a lot of suttas about the Buddhists and the Jains mixing it up. Well, one of them was that this Jain was standing out in an open space staring up at the sun. And the Buddha and a group of his disciples come along, and the Buddha says, "Jain, what are you doing?" And the Jain says, "I'm expending my dharma, my karma." And the Buddha says, how are you doing that?" He says, "I'm just going to stand here and not do anything, and then it'll be expended." And the Buddha said, "Well, how much karma have you got left?" And the Jain said, "Come on, yeah, I don't know." And the Buddha said, "Well, how much have you expended?" Jain said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, how will you know when you're finished?" And the Jain said, "God, I don't know." And the Buddha shook his head. This is my, I'm adding a little human quality here. He must have shaken his head and said, said, "This is truly, truly foolish practice. Because you don't have the view. And you don't have the intention. And unwise view, unwise intention, goes nowhere." Now it's interesting, because some of us have wise view, but we have unwise intention. Here's a perfect example and probably the most frequently asked question. You social engaged activists out there, which almost all of you have some inclination towards that. You hold the view of injustice, of the species fighting itself, and that is not, that doesn't fit your deepest understanding. And so the sense of injustice comes up, and that's from wise view, rightly so. But you put unwise intention of using the very means that created the sense of the schism, the sense of separation to begin with, to employ against that injustice. You use divisive and separate strategies, political or otherwise. That's wise view with unwise intention. And it is the hardest thing to move in accordance, because you're so sure that it's unjust. Right. The heart is absolutely on your side on that one. But you have such a rebellious nature and such a need for your own self, which is your pain, which is our pain. And that must be understood to see why it is that we have to operate in terms of more aggression, more harm. Because that's coming from our pain. Perhaps anger, I don't know, something unresolved in there that needs to be explored. Because the heart does not operate like that. And therefore you are in your mind. And when you're in your mind, you have to understand that you're in your mind because of your personal pain. That's what sends you up to that sphere, to that organ. How many of us are willing to look at our pain before we deal with the pain, which is the injustice that we see? Not very many. You want to solve the problem like you want to solve the problem of your knee pain by adding something, doing something, but not facing it. Not facing it. I'm calling upon a different level of maturity from you. And very few of you can meet me there. But that's where we have to go as a Sangha. Now there's also the possibility of unwise view and wise intention. That's a little more difficult and you can't keep it going long. But just, I was trying to search my examples for one of that. And that is that most of us get started that way. We get started with a very deep and abiding sense of self. And we do our meditation really with that in mind, towards we're going to improve ourselves, which is almost universal when we get going in meditation. So it's not a wrong thing, it just needs to be corrected. But then we start... But then we practice letting be. Our intentionality is towards allowing, letting be, which is wise intention. But it's unwise view. We don't really know what we're doing it for. It doesn't make any sense to us, really. If you look at it, many people say, just looking, what's that going to do? It's not going to do anything. Because nothing needs to be done. Because there's nothing wrong with you. What do you mean there's nothing wrong? You see, when you have unwise view, but you're using the instruction of meditation, which is towards wise view, and the intentionality of that is to not improve, just to observe. Well, observation doesn't fit self-improvement's view. And so really what we then do is pretend not to do while we're doing. Right? I know this because I've done it. I've done it many, many years. And you're not really letting anything be. You're kind of waiting for it to be over. That's what if there's any being that's happening there, it's that. You see? So that needs to be corrected. If things are together, connected, oneness, union. How can we dispute that? Just for a moment, don't see with your eyes. And if your eyes are weighted too much in that way, close them and go to your heart, because right now in the room, you can feel the quality of stillness. And that has nothing to do with the organ of the brain of separation. And it has everything to do with what is already at hand. The home that's already here, if we could quit struggling, if we quit fighting it. And so it becomes so clear. And the more we see, the more we want to see. And the more we see, the more we want to see. And the more this whole thing starts moving outside of the confines of either unwise view or unwise intention. Because it becomes so clear that you can throw a wrench into the whole mechanism of this meditation very, very quickly by bringing unwise view or unwise intention to bear upon it. And it will serve you. That's the problem. Sometimes I wish it wouldn't serve you with unwise view or unwise intention, but it does. It makes you, you know, it gets through somehow, and there's slight modification. There's behavior modification. You are able to listen more. You're able to relax a little more. You're not as stressed. And so those things reinforce that need to use unwise view in our meditation because the gain is there. So I don't know what drops us to the level two, the deeper form of longing. I don't know what drops us to that intentionality around that longing, to move into the source. Because we could improve ourselves with this technique forever. So, for some reason, I was never interested in that. And that's the reason I'm in the shape I'm in. Because I was never interested in using it towards being calm and quiet and nice and all that. Where does my longing pull me? Where does it pull you? Now, I want to mention something. The great inhibitor of that movement energetically towards wise intention. Wise intention can sometimes just be the intention, sometimes pure service or just a loving meal or something you're doing for somebody else for no reason, in particular because you want them to be happy. Huh? Mudita. Or you're just because you're responding to somebody's pain, just spontaneously. But then it goes all weird, gets weird. You're operating from wise view and wise intention, but you're not met with that. You're met with some kind of catastrophe, some fruit that you hadn't thought was going to happen. And there's nothing that will send you out of wise view and wise intention quicker than doubt. There was a hospice nurse I was working with, and, you know, hospice people, when the patient comes under hospice care, they sign a consent form. It says, I understand I'm terminally ill. They have this conversation. And so the nurse went in the next day and sat down, and she was somewhat new on the job, and she said she was talking about, what she'd seen in terms of somebody moving into the later stages of terminal illness, and the man says, what? Terminally ill? I'm not dying. And he just blew up, because denial can be that thick sometimes. And so she came back to the office. I mean, her response was really towards wise view and wise intent. She was doing the best she could. And it blew up in her face. And her doubt, she almost quit the job, it was so terrifying for her. Now, each of us have, perhaps to a lesser or perhaps even greater extent, times when things blow up in our loving face, right? And it throws us back upstairs to level one intention. Level one intention being personal pain and the intention of personal pain. See, self-doubt is there because there's some unaccounted for, unobserved personal pain around inadequacy, unworthiness, something. See, all of this stuff, whoever said that you can be neurotic and be spiritual was completely wrong. You have to clean it all up. This requires 100% sanity, because what takes you away from the spiritual is personal pain and your neurotic states of perception. Neurotic states of perception will confiscate the spiritual. And so you have to clean up that. In fact, that's all you have to do. Because if everything's cleaned up, there's nowhere else you'll go but to wise view and wise intention. It's not an alternative. It's the reality. what forces us into the alternative reality, the false one, is our personal pain. So there's no running away here. And a beautiful way to do that is through interrelationships. That's why, you see, only part of you comes out in a, when you're sitting, and you, when you're by yourself, when you're on retreat, when you're off being a monk or nun somewhere, that's fine. You can deal with an awful lot of intra-psychic pain. But what about all the interpersonal pain? That's a whole level of pain which you can hide because the mind is very nuanced and subtle. You can hide for a long time in your meditation from that pain. But you start interrelating, which is what Sangha is. It's meant to bring forth some of that as well. But with kindness, with other people who can work and operate in accordance with the view you hold. Wise intention. You begin to see when people aren't in wise view and wise intention. You can feel it, can't you? You can feel it when somebody's from a fixed and start feeling it. And the more you can feel it externally, the more you'll be able to feel it internally, or vice versa. And so you begin to pick up where you're opinionated, where you're fixed, where you're postured, where you won't move. And you also start picking it up in the other people. And you see it. You just know it. You feel it in your heart. You feel. You know, it's a significant practice to do nothing else but to know what motivates our action. To see it, to feel the motivation of what we do and why we do it. There's a story of a child who was standing up in their car seat next to her father. As they got into the car, and the father said, "You have to sit down and put your seatbelt on." And the little girl said, "No, I'm not going to put my seatbelt on." The father said, "Well, we're not moving until you do." So the child begrudgingly sat down, put on her seatbelt, and says, "Dad, in my mind, I'm still standing." Without wise intention, we are left standing. Thank you all. Can we spend a minute or two, please, in quiet? Okay, so if there are any questions or comments tonight, I'd be happy to respond. Yes. You know, we have to explore them. We have to understand them. Getting rid of, I might have used that word, but I did, so I did a bit by mistake. When you address your pain, it's not to get rid of the pain. It's to understand where we have lost the truth of what is, we've lost in some way, what pain ultimately is that we have set up an opposition of some other's ideal against what is actually occurring. And the less we resist what is actually occurring, the less pain there'll be. The less we resist what is actually occurring, the less identification there will be with what's occurring, and we will no longer act out those patterns in the way we did when we were afraid of having them. That's how it works. But we have to... We don't believe that. We don't believe that observation and understanding is enough. We feel like the sense of me feels it has to do something about. And it takes a long time to see how just awareness is the solution because it reveals everything. And we are always trying to kind of muscle our way in, you see, to get rid of rather than to understand. So really, the pressure is off. You see, this is the good news, is that you really don't have to do anything about yourself except understand you. It's already happening. If it weren't already happening, it would be a burden because then you'd have to make up something so that you could see it. But it's already occurring. So all I'm asking you to do is to be aware of what's already occurring and just don't be afraid of it. And the whole thing takes care of itself from there. You see, said like that, you can see how easy and inviting the whole practice is. Because we're really not asking you to be anything different. If I were, then I would be in wrong view. See, this thing has to work completely from top to bottom in wise view. If we stray outside of wise view or wise intention, then we're going to create havoc for ourselves either now or at some point. Yes.
So, during this observation process, I'm beginning to notice that all of the certain kinds of...
You have to speak up.
If I'm engaging in certain kinds of thoughts,
yes.
Or I begin to notice that, you know, I'm going through a pattern.
Yes.
And I see it.
Yes.
And yet I'm still in it.
Yes.
I'm not controlling it in any way.
Yes.
I couldn't if I wanted to.
Yes. Right.
Here I am in the middle of it.
Right.
And I'm noticing that it's happening.
Right.
And I'm becoming, it seems like you just get to the point where you kind of just give up and you just sort of watch it happen and you know that you're watching it. And I guess my hope is that in time, it will begin, a solution will be presented.
Yes. Okay. So let me walk you through that. That's a very good, thank you for that question. The question was concerning the repetitive quality of some of our more ingrained patterns and how watching, there's just repetition of the watching and nothing seems to really be moving. It's a very good question. A couple of things. The most important thing is to get the data. You see, sometimes when we watch, we're not getting the complete data. We're kind of watching with one eye and the other eye is hoping that it goes quickly so that we can don't have to watch it anymore. There's the two levels of intention working there. Both levels simultaneously, right? I know I'm supposed to connect, but I don't really want to connect. So you've got to get the data down. The best orientation for that is a cultural anthropologist. Cultural anthropologist gets the data. They're like Star Trek. They don't interfere with the alien culture. They just get the language down. They get the behavior down. They watch it. They watch the assumptions. They watch the language that one is saying to themselves that creates this whole thing. You don't want to bend even a single blade of grass. You just want to observe it. Just get the data. This is not you. This is a foreign culture, the pygmies, and you're landing in the middle and you just want to know exactly what so you have to do all of that. I'm really, because what we usually do is anything but that. We'll get the emotion. Now it's gone, thank God. But we're not, it's not really inviting a complete observation. Okay? So, go with your notebook and start writing things down. Oh, when this happens, this happens, and there's the language I use with myself. Sometimes you'll have to do that retrospectively because you'll be too immersed in it afterwards. And you write down the things you've been saying to yourself and just look at the nonsense of those things that you're saying to yourself. Begin to get the details of that pattern. Second, equally as important, is patience. Patience. There is value in repetition. There is value. Often you don't realize you're walking a 1% slope until you've walked a real long time. You can look back and you can see the height that's been gained. So you are walking a 1% slope, especially if you're talking about life central core issues in yourself. Those core issues play themselves out far beyond what we think is just this particular pattern. If you look, you'll see the root system of that core issue play itself out in almost every nod and every interpersonal word you say. So you have to look at the root system, because it's one thing to just get the main issue, but if the root system continues to reassert the strategies and assumption of that main issue, then unless you get those side issues, you're not going to get the whole story. See? So don't pretend, let's not pretend together that we've seen the whole thing and it's just going on and on and on. Let's really look at some of the assumptions on which these core issues are based and really challenge those assumptions. There's only one place that you can challenge those assumptions, and that's in the moment. Don't challenge them in retrospect by thinking, well, I was this way and I did that, and no wonder I'm feeling that way, and yes, that the analysis of it really has nothing to say that will allow you to let that pattern go. What will let that pattern go is if in the moment you see that saying to yourself, I'm like this or I'm like that, has no bearing on anything, because in the moment we are not formed by those patterns. And you can see yourself from an unformed place looking at the formation, the tsunami wave of formation coming over you, and thinking, I can surf this. You can't do it if you're in the wave struggling to get some breath, you see. That will come when you get the data. You get the data, you get the impersonal quality of this thing. This thing is talking to me. It's not me. It's talking to me. Convincing me that I'm this thing. Okay. Thank you all very much tonight.